This podcast is produced and issued by Morningstar Investment Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor and subsidiary of Morningstar, Inc. The content is intended for U.S. audiences only. Individuals featured in this podcast are employed by Morningstar, Inc. and its subsidiaries. This includes, but is not limited to, Morningstar Investment Management, LLC, and Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Investment Management and Morningstar Research Services are registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Stay tuned for additional important disclosure information at the end of this episode.
Markets have taken investors on a roller coaster ride in 2020, and this can cause stress and anxiety, which can in turn lead to impulsive decision making. So today, we're looking at how investors can make better decisions under stress and understand the emotions that uncertain markets bring. That's today on Simple But Not Easy, a podcast about investing and behavioral science by Morningstar Investment Management. I'm your host, Drew Carter. Joining me today to share some insights from behavioral science are Sarah Newcomb, Director of Behavioral Science at Morningstar, Inc., and Ryan Murphy, Head of Decision Sciences at Morningstar Investment Management. I want to start with you, Sarah. Markets have been all over the place in the last few months, which has likely elicited a range of emotions in investors. How can these emotions affect decision-making?
Yes, markets have been all over the place, and a lot of us are experiencing emotional and cognitive fatigue from the fact that our habitual routines have been disrupted for 10 weeks or more at this point, and that the quote-unquote new normal is not normal at all. It's a seemingly unending progression of disruptive changes. And so what do we do? Well, we can't avoid the reality that we're experiencing and probably will continue to experience stress, uncertainty, and change. But the question is, how do we cope? And our brains naturally want to cope by becoming rigid. Imagine your brain tightening up in a little ball to avoid the chaos. It might feel a little bit comforting to freeze yourself up, but cognitive rigidity has been repeatedly linked to suboptimal decision making. So if you let your brain curl up into that tight little ball, you're less likely to be able to make great decisions right now. So one thing we all need to be on the lookout for is cognitive rigidity. So how do you know if you're experiencing it? Well, you know those times when you're too tired or you're too stressed or just too irritated to have an open mind? And that's cognitive rigidity. And it's when we get stuck in a particular way of thinking, even in spite of evidence to the contrary. And it's a defense mechanism that our brains use when we're stressed or overwhelmed. So we're going to try to cling to really simple, easy to remember rules of thumb, because they're simpler and it relieves pressure from our brain. But the problem again is that this actually leads us to less good decision making. And right now, what we probably need to be doing is being open to new information and thinking of ways to adapt to the moment. So cognitive rigidity is something that we've got to be on the lookout for. If you find yourself relying on a lot of rules of thumb lately, you might have a tired and stressed brain. But often rules of thumbs can be helpful shortcuts, and relying on familiar patterns of thinking can be a time saver. That's why our brains do this. But what we really need to do is avoid knee-jerk decisions and faulty judgments. So if you find yourself with cognitive rigidity, to be honest, one of the best things you can do is rest. Your brain will thank you, and you will be more open to new information on the other side of that rest. And it's being open to new information that allows us to be adaptable.
Yeah, Sarah, that resonates with me. Definitely feel that cognitive rigidity at times of stress and when I haven't rested. What about fear? I would imagine a lot of people felt fear when markets dropped more than 30% earlier this year. How does that kind of fear affect decision-making?
Mm-hmm. Fear is huge right now and has been over the last few months. But people have really strong and really different responses to fear. We typically think of risk aversion and as a response to fear, but really we have three major responses: fight, flight, and freeze. The flight response wants to run away from the scary thing, and that's risk avoidance. So even if in simpler or more steady times you felt sure that you would be able to handle the volatility of the stock market, if you looked at your portfolio in March, you might have seen it drop 30%. I know I did. It was a gut punch. 30% gone, or seemingly gone. And it's really difficult to experience that and not want to run away from it if your response to fear is a flight response. But the problem with this is that what's happening is actually not what we're trying to do when we become increasingly risk averse during volatility, is we're trying to reduce future uncertainty. And we pay a heavy, heavy price for that. Because what will happen is that people are so desperate to feel sure that at least they won't lose more, that they're willing to lock in major losses. And if people sold stocks and sold things at a loss in March, they may not have been able to recoup that, where people who stayed in are probably right back to where they, or at least very close to where they were before by now. So the issue with this is, if you're not being focused on the underlying value of the investments that you hold, then an increase in risk aversion and a desire to run away from the scary situation there, that is, run out of the stock market or the funds market, what can happen is you can end up selling things for far less than they're actually worth. And then it's going to be much harder for you to recover from that. Another response that we have to fear is the opposite, is actually running toward it. This is the fight response to fear. And in the investment world, what this looks like is those of us that say, oh, wow, the market's down. I want in. I want to buy everything I can. And while it can be a great opportunity, we can also be overconfident in our stock picking prowess in times like this. And so if you were fortunate enough to have cash on hand in a time like this, then you have the opportunity that you can buy wonderful things at great prices. But if you're focused more on the adrenaline rush of getting in while things are low and less on the fundamental value of the assets that you're buying, again, you can lose money by letting adrenaline fuel the rush into the market rather than making good long-term calculated decisions about what is truly undervalued in the current market. So again, paying attention to fundamental value is a really good way to mitigate the effects of both of fear, whether it's fear that makes you want to run out of investments. Why would you sell something if it's selling for less than it's truly worth? And why would you buy something for more than it's truly worth? Staying focused on fundamental value. The other really strong response to fear is paralysis. And this is the freeze response. And that may not hurt you that much in a situation where buying and holding tends to be the strategy that most advisors are saying, just stay the course. But it can hurt you if you are sitting on cash in a market where there are real undervalued things that you could take advantage of. But if you're too afraid to invest at all, if you're frozen with uncertainty, then you won't be able to take advantage of good opportunities when they exist. I think the things we really need to be focused on in how fear affects our mind, one of the biggest things that fear does is it shrinks our mental time horizon. We're bad enough at thinking into the future in normal times. Most people aren't thinking along a 20 or 30 year timeline financially, which is at the root of many, many financial problems. But when we're afraid, that mental timeline contracts and we can't see as far. With uncertainty, it's even worse, because you'll hear a lot of people talking lately about you know, so much uncertainty, you think, well, if you can't predict what's going to happen next week, how can you predict what's going to happen in 10 years? But the stock market has always been that way. We've always said, you know, in the short term, you can't make predictions, but in the long term, there are some fundamental mechanisms that you can somewhat rely on. And so if you can focus on your long-term vision, your brain is going to want to stay in the now, but you need to force yourself out of that myopic viewpoint and remember 20 years from now, maybe where your goal is. And if your goal time horizon is in 20 years, then what the stock market is doing today is really irrelevant to your goals. So staying focused on your goals as the benchmark and the fundamental value of assets that you buy and sell, not current market prices, can really help assuage, or not assuage, but mitigate the effects of fear.
Okay, Sarah. Fear is one thing, but what about stress, which I would imagine to be more common? So, for example, given what's happened in the past few months, unemployment has skyrocketed. Those who haven't lost their jobs have had to adjust to working from home. Some have had to juggle that with teaching their kids during e-learning. Can you talk a bit about stress?
Yeah, stress as distinct from fear has some implications on behavior that can be really detrimental, specifically rumination. And rumination is a little different from fear. Rumination is when we get stuck in a cycle of negative thinking, and it's exhausting to our brain. So ruminating is when you are up at 2 a.m. trying to think through your finances and you're stressed, but you can't sleep because your brain is telling you you have to solve this problem. Well, rumination is exhausting physically and mentally, and it's been linked to present bias. So when you ruminate, you tend to be in a short-term mindset. We forget the long-term. And when you ruminate, you're really draining your cognitive capacity. And so ruminating is problem solving on overdrive, and it becomes a really, rather than solving the problem, we make it worse because we tire ourselves out. And so if you find yourself or someone else ruminating, it's really, really important to stop. And it can be very hard to stop when you're ruminating. So actually, there's a very interesting, there was an interesting study that was done at Columbia a few years back. Hasn't gotten a lot of airtime, but it was fascinating to me that it had some evidence for the idea that if you're stuck ruminating on financial uncertainty or financial stress, one of the things that seems to help, this seems strange, but seems to help, is thinking through the people who have been emotional supports to you in your life in the past. Not financial, emotional. And I have a hunch that what's happening here is that when we recognize that we have people who care for us regardless of our financial situation, we can breathe and remember that even if the worst happens, they will still be there. But regardless of why it seems to work, thinking about your social support network may be able to break the spell of rumination, at least long enough that you can start to get that long-term time horizon back, that you can stop with the myopia and the spinning, the unproductive spinning that you get caught in with rumination. So if you or someone else you know is ruminating in financial stress right now, focusing on the people who are a social support can be really good. And that's, I think, something that many people are really feeling right now, is that need for social support where we're all separated from one another. But it's just another reason why we need each other.
Yeah, worrying about the future is big, I think, especially when things feel so uncertain. But Sarah, can you talk about dealing with the past when something has already happened that's upsetting you?
I think one thing we don't talk about enough in finance is grief. Loss, it hurts. And loss of money hurts. It can represent the loss of dreams and hopes. It can represent so much that we may have wanted to do that either no longer can or are afraid that we can't. But when we have lost something, whether it is a person, people who are dealing with the physical loss from COVID and other things right now, grief is powerful, and grief is really detrimental to our decision making. when if you're grieving, whether it's, and first of all, I want to say it is okay to grieve the loss of money. It is so okay. There's a lot of research in psychology around possessions, the possession self link, and how everything that we own or feel any sense of ownership over does become integrated into our sense of identity. So if someone, this is why when someone has objects stolen, they grieve. I had my bike stolen once and it felt personal. It's because the things that you own, including your money, become a part of the sense of who you are. And if you lose that, there is a grieving process that goes along with it. And if you deny yourself that because you say, oh, it's just money, I shouldn't be grieving, I shouldn't feel this bad about it, that makes me a bad person, then you won't process grief. And if you don't process grief, that can lead to all sorts of health and mental health problems. So recognize that if you have lost something, there is a grieving that needs to happen, and that's okay. Let yourself grieve. Also, if you are around other people who have lost and are grieving, there's a thing called compassion fatigue that happens if you're a caregiver, and I think a lot of people right now are experiencing this if they are essential workers and frontline workers in COVID, is when you are caring for others and you're experiencing the grief of others, and you're carrying that burden for other people, you can burn out. And but there are resources that you can seek for support on compassion fatigue. If you just Google compassion fatigue resources, there are groups and there are people that can help. But I just think it's really important to recognize that loss of money is a loss, and it's okay to grieve that loss. If you don't, you may make worse decisions moving forward.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. So can you talk a little bit about how the feeling of urgency can affect decision making? And, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of how the media is maybe affecting that?
Yeah, I think Ryan will probably touch on this a bit too, that headlines are really good at making us think we must act now, that something is happening, whether good or bad, that you have to jump in and act. And that, again, urgency has been shown, just the mere urgency effect, it can mess with our prioritization. And so when something feels urgent, we often will attend to that and give it our attention, even if it's not important. And so then the things that are important don't get the attention they need because they weren't as urgent. And we probably all experienced times when we spent a lot of time dealing with urgent things that didn't really matter that much, and then ended up neglecting the important things. And so we have to be careful around that. But I think with headlines, news, the constant news cycle around money and the stock market, we have to be really careful because any updated news can make you feel like if you don't act now, you'll lose out. And so be careful of urgency. It messes with our weighting of priority. And so if you're feeling a sense of urgency, remember just to take a breath. Nothing must be done immediately. And you can take a breather and at least sleep on it before making a decision.
That's great. Wonderful insights. Thank you, Sarah. I want to bring Ryan Murphy into the conversation now. Ryan, you recently wrote a research paper about what investors look for in a financial advisor. Where did the role of a financial advisor helping manage emotions land in the ranking of what was important to people?
Right. So this was a study where we asked people lots of different attributes they might look for when hiring a financial advisor, what they look for when they seek financial advice. And this idea of managing emotions came in last place. And this was a big surprise to us because this idea of managing emotions and behavioral coaching turns out to be one of the major sources of value that comes from the financial advice process. So we see this as a major oversight that investors have in not realizing the kinds of value they can get from this kind of relationship and that guidance. We found that investors would sometimes focus a bit more on beating benchmarks or maximizing returns, for example. And this, I think, again, is a misstep of allocation of attention. They would be better off if they were thinking about their long-term financial goals and what they needed to do as investors through saving and asset allocation to meet those goals. And that's part of the process of getting there and also staying on track. And so there's this idea that their emotions might short circuit that plan and that advisors can be there to step in and help them stay on track. There's this great Warren Buffett quote I've always liked talking about what investment success is. Said that investment to invest successfully over a lifetime doesn't require stratospheric IQ, unusual business insights, or insight information. What's needed is a sound intellectual framework for making decisions and the ability to keep emotions from corroding that framework. And so I think this builds on a lot of the ideas that Sarah was talking about, how people under stress and fear can narrow their attention and undermine the quality of decision-making they have and undermine the execution of their long-term financial plans.
So in addition to the mix of emotions we feel, we humans also have to deal with the raft of cognitive biases, right? There are systematic errors in the way we tend to think about things, and we all tend to fall prey to these at some time or another. Ryan, what are some of the major biases affecting decision-making that investors should be wary of?
Right. So there's lots of biases. So if you go check out the Wikipedia page on biases of decision-making, there are literally hundreds that are listed there. But there are some that really stand out that I think investors should be most knowledgeable of and wary of. So I'd say one of the big ones is the confirmation bias. And so this is a tendency people have to look for evidence that already confirms one of their existing conclusions. They only look for supporting evidence. And you could see how that could get a person into trouble, that they're only looking for one side of the story, when really things could be much more complicated. So one thing that's worth reminding yourself as an investor is that on every side of a trade, there's someone else. And it's worth assuming that they're every bit as smart as you are and every bit as motivated to make money. What might they think? What might they know that you don't? And I think that that reflection can give people a little bit of pause and perhaps not make knee-jerk decisions. There's also something called the recency bias. And this is a trick about how our memory works. It's easier to remember things that just happened. And so when we start to think about weighing evidence, things that are most easily to recall or most easy to recall carry the most weight. And so, for example, during the middle of a bull market, it's really easy to remember the upside of markets. And that can lead people to misunderstand what risks are and what's inherent in investing. I occasionally hear investors say, you know, I'm thinking about investing over the next 30 years. What happens if I go through a recession? It's not if, it's a matter of how many based on how market cycles work. I think it's this tendency people have to think in the very short term, when really investing is much more of a long-term process. One other thing to be wary of is the herding bias. And so this is sometimes a useful heuristic as we navigate the social world. We look at what other people are doing, and sometimes that can be a useful cue as to what makes for a good option. For example, if you're picking where to eat at a restaurant, popular restaurants are often better. So it's a useful clue. However, in investing, this can lead to a nasty feedback cycle, where if more people start to pile into something, the prices diverge from the underlying fundamentals. And this is the sort of thing that is not long-term investing, but rather speculation. So I think that's a thing to be mindful of. But again, when people become more stressed, they're looking for these kinds of cues from the outside, and herding can become all the more attractive. So I think there are lots of the biases that we know about, but I think these are some of the larger ones we see. I think all of it can play into overconfidence, which is also people's tendency to overestimate their ability to time the market. And we see over and over again that the more people fiddle with their asset allocation over time, the worse they do. And loss aversion. This is a big one, and Sarah mentioned this. And this is just worth being mindful that losses hurt more than gains feel good. And so it's worth being careful about this and not checking one's portfolio too frequently. Because the more often you look, the more often you're going to see the volatility, and that can cycle back and induce people to make worse decisions. So I think this idea of stepping back, trying to view from the long perspective, is really useful to try and help people reorient and make better long-term decisions.
Yeah, great suggestions, Ryan. We've talked a lot about the dangers emotions can cause for investors. Is there any upside for emotion in this picture?
Well, one study we did in the last year looked at what sort of goals people have. And we found that if you ask people off the top of their head what are their overarching financial goals, they would say something, but it often didn't have an emotional resonance. So they'd say something like generate returns or pay for incidentals. And that's not really probably reflective of what's motivating them as an investor. I think what we're interested in is people's long-term goals. And when it comes down to it, people's goals are really the big things that matter. And so we developed a process of a checklist where people had a chance to think and reflect on what their overarching goals were. And we found at the end of that process, when we'd ask people again, all right, so what are your investing goals? They would sometimes give pretty different answers. they'd be more specific, and often they'd be much more emotionally grounded. For example, things like, I want to avoid being a burden on my children as I get older. And that's something that really has deep emotional resonance. And that makes a lot of sense. When you think of the goals people are investing for, they're thinking about a safe and secure retirement, building up and establishing a home for them and their family, helping pay for continuing education for loved ones. And all of these goals are imbued with emotion. And that's a good thing. So I think that being able to remind people of the big why they're investing, it's not about beating benchmarks. It's about meeting our personal financial goals. And reminding them of that why makes the how more endurable in some way. And so as they start to experience market volatility, reminding people of the long-term goals that they have can help them refocus their attention, which I think is really very useful. And one last additional point, this is from a study we're just in the middle of conducting now. We're looking at the sort of information that people have access to. And this attention allocation study, we had people set up a hypothetical long-term investment account. And we experimentally controlled what information they had access to as they were picking out these different investments. So for some people, they only had access to historical prices, whereas other people had information to things like ESG ratings, the sustainability rating of different investments. Now, not everyone cares about this, but some people do. And as it turns out, when we were running this study, that a fair number of people were paying attention to this ESG information, even during the wild volatility that we saw in March. We found that even during this period of tremendous market volatility, ESG was still important to many investors. And the sustainability information that we provided was used by them, and that their portfolios became more ESG friendly, which is interesting to see. So they're thinking about investing not just from return generation, but also voting with their dollars, consistent with their personal values in some way. But one of the interesting side effects of this was that people tended to returns chase less by having access to this information. So I think what it did is broaden the scope of what people were thinking about when they're investing, and that helped them avoid some of the pitfalls of just putting money on what was a recent winner, which we know is not a long-term investment policy that works very well. So I thought that was interesting. It's research we're conducting now. We'll have more results hopefully in the next months.
Excellent. Thanks so much for being here again, Ryan, and big thanks to you, Sarah. And while I'm at it, big thanks for listening today. You've been listening to Simple But Not Easy. I'm Drew Carter. Bye for now.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of publication. Such opinions are subject to change. No Morningstar entity, including Morningstar Investment Management and Morningstar Research Services, shall be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the content presented. Morningstar makes no representation as of the completeness or accuracy of the information presented. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.